You would have expected Nephron joined his shield, but maybe that wasn't the Galantian way. Sebek sat up in his bed, naked to the waist, his torso wrapped in white bandages. Lightning and thunder lay on either side of him, a pair of guard dogs that would give pause to anyone who knew the fray. Even as badly wounded as he was, Sebek was dangerous. The Fane's army had found their goal, their prize. They had chased Nephron up the stairs into the Koenig's room, into the shrine. No one had thought to open this nondescript door. No one, except Tesh. He regretted not being with Bryn, but there wasn't much he could do for her, or anyone. There was no winning that battle, but there was one victory Tesh could still achieve. Sebek looked surprised. "What are you doing here?" "Can't expect enemies to be courteous and only attack when you're prepared. Sometimes they catch you off guard in awkward places where you can't retreat," Tesh told him.
"What are you talking about?"
"Don't you remember saying that on the bridge when you tried to kill me?" Tesh closed the door, while Sebek intently watched. "I did pretty good, didn't I?" Tesh slid the deadbolt. "I held my own there for a while. I think I surprised you." Tesh offered a grin, then shrugged. "I'm still not as good as you. My wrists aren't as strong, and your speed is superior. You would have beaten me, killed me, if Bryn hadn't interfered. But overall, I did surprise you, didn't I? A rune like me. Just a kid. Going toe-to-toe with Sebek." Tesh nodded. "I've learned a lot. Not enough to beat you. Not enough to seriously challenge any of the Galantians, let alone the best of them. But eventually... well, now we'll never know." Sebek didn't move, didn't speak, but he watched Tesh's every movement. "You know, when I first met Wraith, he taught me that the best way to learn how to kill someone is to discover everything you can about how they fight. Determine their strengths and weaknesses, uncover their secrets, and never let them see yours. That's what he told me. Every night since then, I've gone to sleep with those words running through my head. He was right. But I thought I'd have more time, you know?"
"You sauce," Sebek said, his hands clasping the handles of his swords.
"When you and the rest of the Galantians came to my village?" Tesh nodded. "My mother was a wise and intelligent woman. At the first hint of your coming, she sent me into the cellar. We were poor. Everyone was. And our storeroom was little more than a hole in the ground, bordered by bricks. Didn't even have the wood for a door. My father went out, buying my mother time. She put me in, covered the hole with a rug, and moved the bed over, all of it. Then she left to join my dad. From the outside, the cellar was invisible. I removed a brick, and through the tiny gap I watched you kill my father. While she cried over his dead body, you cut my mother's head off." Tesh pointed at the left sword. "With thunder, I believe. She was a woman, not worthy of lightning. Isn't that right? And yet, in a way, she'd bested you. You never found what she had hidden." Sebek struggled to pull himself more upright and winced at the effort. "You Galantians are such heroes. I could tell that just watching you, the way you slaughtered everyone. All the unarmed men, the women as they clutched their babies, and the children. Yes, nothing screams hero quite like butchering an innocent child. I used to think you burned everything just to be thorough, or because your Fane ordered it.
But he doesn't even know, does he? He never ordered that attack. Never ordered any assault. The war with the Frey didn't exist until you started it. You murdered everyone in Dorea and Nadak to terrify the rest of the clans. You wanted us to think the Fane was our enemy, that we had no choice but to fight back. This war was Nefren's idea. Isn't that right?
Sebek didn't reply, but his eyes were wide. Tesh took that as a sign of confirmation. Nefren wants to be Fane, but you can't break the law of your god and still rule in his name, can you? Thirol forbids Frey from killing Frey. So Nefren needed a rune army to do what he couldn't. Sebek finally spoke. You're here to kill me.
Tesh was pleased. He wanted to be sure Sebek understood everything.
Tesh had waited a long time. He felt he deserved at least that much.
I'd kill you all, if I had the time.
So, why save Nefren from the row? Tesh smiled as he slowly drew his sword.
I wanted to be the one to kill each of you.
He sighed. But Nefren is probably already dead, so I saved him for nothing.
But of the two, I'd rather it be you.
Nefren only gave the order.
You were the one who killed my family.
Every day, for nearly a year, I choked back vomit as I pretended to be your devoted student, waiting until I had the skills. You think that because I'm wounded you can take me?
Yes.
Sebek gritted his teeth, grabbed his swords, and swung his feet to the floor.
Tesh let him.
Tesh fainted with his left. Sebek met him. In that clash, everything was made clear. Sebek's block was weak, without follow-through.
I'm doing him a favor. He wants me to kill him.
No better death for a warrior than in battle. But Tesh wasn't there to merely kill Sebek. He wanted to hurt the Frey, let him know what loss felt like. Roan's iron blade proved to be able to deliver on its promise. He struck lightning with all his might, and was rewarded when the bronze sword was severed at the hilt.
That is for my father.
He could have killed Sebek then, but Tesh wouldn't grant the Frey any favors. His next blows weren't aimed at flesh, but at thunder. Acting as giant scissors, Tesh's sword caught Sebek's remaining blade between two strong swings, and it, too, snapped.
That is for my mother.
Sebek staggered backward. He wasn't looking at Tesh. His eyes were focused on the broken hilts, as if his hands had been cut off. Tesh paused to let the full weight of the pain sink in.
Tears slipped down Sebek's cheeks.
Now you know, Tesh said. Now you understand. He let Sebek cry. The Frey dropped to his knees and wept over the broken blades. Tesh gave him a full minute before severing his head from his neck. To Persephone's surprise and relief, neither Moya nor Grigor were dead. Both got back to their feet, merely knocked down by a strong wind. Shock gave way to puzzlement.
Why are they still alive?
The answer was written all over Moya. After the first battle, she had painted runes on everything she had, but Grigor didn't have any, and he didn't wear armor. The Merilith should have at least killed the giant, but since the Merilith couldn't always tell who wore Orinfar and who didn't, he likely always attacked with air. Grigor was up again,
Recognizing the greatest threat and forsaking all others, he launched himself at the bald figure. The Myrilith either noticed Grygor didn't have armor, or the fear of a rampaging giant had caused the fray to act out of reflex. In any case, his defense wasn't another blast of air. A brilliant white light struck the giant.
"Grygor!"
Hedera yelled. Her voice was louder than Persephone thought possible. The giant died in an instant. The Myrilith died a half-second later as Moya, having risen to a knee, held Audrey sideways and launched two arrows before Grygor hit the floor. The first entered the Myrilith's throat. The second got him in the eye.
"In the name of Fane Lothian!" Persephone heard the shout from the other room. "Face your punishment, Nephron, son of Zephyron!"
Nephron pushed Bergen through the threshold, and then he and Tekchin pulled a bleeding Ares into Persephone's bedchamber. This would be their final stand. Moya leapt up on the bed and resumed firing arrows, but Persephone noticed she was down to only the ones in her hands. Tegan, Bergen, and a blood-covered Harkon took positions around the bed where Bryn and Persephone clutched swords, and Pedera prayed to Mara, rubbing a small, polished stone carving of their god. Ares got back to his feet and made great use of his spear's long reach. For a time, he forced the Fane's invaders to stay back where they were easy targets for Moya's bow. She slew four, but had only three arrows left. Maybe because they finally realized the Galantians weren't willing to kill fellow Frey, six invaders rushed forward, forcing their way into the bedroom. Harkon threw himself forward, swinging. A bronze sword entered his chest, and he fell. Bergen killed a Frey that Tekchin had distracted, with a slash across the face. Moya killed another. Then Bergen went down. Persephone didn't even see the blow that killed him. Nephron, Tekchin, Ares, and Tegan were all that remained between the Fane's Frey and the bed, and the other Frey seemed to know that the Galantians were harmless. A spear slammed into the headboard 5 inches from Persephone's head, and she screamed. Together, Pedera and Bryn jerked the spear free, and the old woman took it, aiming the point in defense of the bed. 4 more Frey pushed into the room, and Tekchin took a blade thrust to his chest. The stroke landed under his breastplate, and he cried out. Moya's howl was even louder.
"No!"
She straddled Persephone and fired her last 2 arrows, one after another, into the chests of the newcomers. Each fell, but they were instantly replaced. Bryn pulled Moya down to the mattress as another spear flew. Just missing her, the weapon sparked off the stonework.
"A curse on you, Lothian!" Nephron shouted. "A curse on you and your entire Tetlan house!"
Bryn raised her dagger as more Frey rushed into the bedroom. Persephone gritted her teeth against the pain and raised her blade. She muttered a prayer to Mara. That's when the roof came off the kipe. Chapter 29 The Light on Shining Armor. The way Rhone described it, the rising sun, the bridge, the beating of her heart, I wish I could have seen it. I wish everyone could have. It was what fairy tales are made of. The Book of Bryn. Rhone had watched the entire thing through a wash of tears. She didn't mean to. Not the whole thing. She had planned to close her eyes before Suri killed him. Didn't seem right to watch that part, but it had happened so fast. Suri had asked Wraith to lie down. She picked up the sword, and Rhone expected she would cut off his head, or raise it up and stab him in the chest, maybe cut his throat. Instead, she laid the sword on his chest, then she stroked his forehead, whispered something, leaned over, and kissed him on the brow. That was it. Wraith was dead. Roan hadn't realized it at first. The only hint was that Suri cried out as if someone had stabbed her. She began to sob, to wail, her body racked with grief, tears spilling down her face. Somehow, in her horrific sorrow, Suri managed to sing. Not a nice song, not a song at all, really. Nothing rhymed, and the melody was unpleasant. Then the rear wall of the smithy shattered, part of the roof caved in, and the beast appeared. The workshop was simply too small for the Galarabrin that was born of that sorrow. The Verinthian wouldn't have been big enough. Just as Arion had tapped from all of them when they had been in the Agave, Suri had drawn on their combined grief, and what was born from it was impossible to fully comprehend. The next moment, the Galarabrin flew into the night sky. Scale-covered body, massive claws, horned back, barbed tail, and an overabundance of teeth were hoisted by a pair of featherless wings.
Bigger, she thought, wiping tears away. Much bigger than last time.
The Galarabrin gained height, took one circle over the wrist, then dove on the kype, claws extended the way Roan had seen birds do on the big lake or the White Oak River. They usually came up with a fish in their talons. The Galarabrin came up with the roof.
Definitely bigger.
Suri sat beside Wraith and Arion. She was still rocking and crying. Malcolm, Tressa, the little men, even Rain, they all cried. Roan had been surprised at that. She didn't know why. The little men just didn't seem the type. They didn't laugh or cry. They yelled quite often. At least Frost and Flood did, usually at each other, and occasionally at a hammer. Time stopped after that. The smithy was gone, most of it, and Roan was looking out at the courtyard, where dozens of Freys stood. The elves, blood-covered and carrying swords, spears, and shields, had stopped too, frozen in shock at what they saw. Yet, as the Galarabrin flew away, time started again. Beyond the world of the broken smithy, Roan saw a battlefield where a quiet courtyard had been. Frey warriors in gold and blue fought men in shining silver. Swords clanged, shields rang, blood and fire filled the cracks between. Malcolm valiantly stepped forward, holding his spear. The little men grabbed their hammers from the rack, and even Tressa found a weapon, the iron poker from the forge. Roan didn't move. Instead, she counted the enemy that came at them. 5. 3 from the left, and 2 from the right. One more looked their way, but couldn't make up his mind. She estimated their chance of surviving the next 5 minutes, those in the smithy at least, to be non-existent. When Malcolm unexpectedly skewered the first Frey with his spear, she revised her estimate to almost non-existent. Dragging the sword she had laid on Wraith a moment before, Suri began to crawl. She started in the direction of the ruined barracks, but wavered, turning toward the woodpile. Roan was certain the mystic had no idea where she was going. Remembering her state after killing Mina, Roan guessed Suri was dazed and drained and merely moving for the sake of moving. Then Roan heard a noise to her left and realized one of the Frey was looking at her. At the poor girl in the leather apron, sitting between the anvil and the work table. He was strangely bare-handed and bare-headed, with a gash across his nose and cheek. Part of his face was also burned, the hair on the left side of his head singed away. And he was covered in blood, not just his clothes, but every part of him appeared as though he'd bathed in a tub. He had a gleeful grin, an insane smile. The same sort Ivor had worn. She knew what was coming. She'd watched Ivor do it to her mother. The bloody fray came at her, dodging around Malcolm and the little men who had their own problems. Tressa took a swipe, but the poker only rang off his armour. Another fray appeared, and Tressa had her own adversary to deal with. It was just the two of them then, the bloody Ivor look-alike and Roan. Slick hands clutched Roan's throat, and the fray said something she didn't understand. She didn't need to. She'd heard the words before. She'd felt those fingers, too. All of it came back. Roan wasn't in a shattered smithy in an elven fortress. She was in a small roundhouse in Dol Ren. But this Ivor was wearing armour, a dented, blood-soaked bronze breastplate. Roan had invented the pocket because she hated not having things within easy reach when she needed them. The panic bag was the next evolutionary step, but upon becoming the chief smith of Alan Rist, neither had been good enough. Out of necessity, Roan had created a tool belt that she wore under her apron. Hanging from it were a small pair of tongs, tin snips, her gloves, her hammer, and three metal punches. Each had a different purpose. The one she used for detail work was the size of her longest finger. The second was about the size of her hand. The last, which she used to punch holes in iron sheets, was a foot long and sharp as a needle. She'd used these tools every day for almost a year. Each had become an extension of her body, and as with any job that needed doing, Roan's hands found the appropriate tools without having to be told. As darkness began to close in from the edges of her sight, she placed the point of the metal punch on the neat little dent in the fray's breastplate. One strike from Banger the Heavy sent the spike through the armour. After the first swing, the pressure on her throat eased. After the second strike, it disappeared altogether. Suri saw Frey grab Roan and throttle her like a doll, only to collapse, unmoving, a second later. All around, people fought in a blur of movement and muffled sounds. Frost landed a blow with a hammer, shattering a Frey leg. Flood was hit and fell beside the forge. Rain put the point of his pick through the back of the fray that had attacked Tressa. Bodies, both human and fray, filled the courtyard, soft, twisted lumps of cloth and flesh amidst the broken stone and splintered wood. Farther out, the city burned. Smoke, black and sooty, swirled in gusts, rising toward a pale sky. Morning was creeping in unannounced behind dark clouds. The big dome had collapsed. The Corbel Bridge was still there, but the top of the Kype was gone. The Galarabrin was digging into it like a bear into a beehive. As she watched, people were tossed out, but these bees didn't have wings, and the bodies plummeted. Suri was too far away to see if the Galarabrin was being careful. She had no idea if that rain was human, friendly fray, or enemy elf. She hadn't given specific orders to it, other than to fight in defense of the fortress. She trusted that, like the one born of Mina, this new Galarabrin possessed understanding and a good degree of self-determination. The fact that it flew straight to the Kype and Persephone suggested it had that, and maybe something more. A flood of fray spilled out the door at the bottom of the Kype. They retreated back across the damaged Corbel Bridge. The Galarabrin dove from its perch on a corner of the Kype's ruined roof, and a blast of fire shot from its mouth. The spray of flames created animated torches, some of whom jumped off the bridge, leaving bright streaks of light in their wake. "Like fireflies," she thought. Suri was still staring in shock when Tressa seized her by the arm and jerked her up. "Get off the damn floor and do something!" Suri didn't have to do anything. As the fray closed in, She instinctively tugged on the leash. She hadn't realized there was one. A static connection between her and the Galarabrin. Until that moment. She realized then that she'd performed a similar tug in Neith when the Rao had grabbed her. She and her creations were linked, and her need became its concern. The Galarabrin fanned out its great wings and took flight. One thrump, and it dove. As it did, Suri closed her eyes and repeated in her head, "Don't kill us all!"
"What in Feral's name is that?"
the Thane asked. He sat in the big chair they had brought from Estramnadon. Made of gold and velvet, his portable throne was mounted on a wooden base that had been anchored into the ground with spikes to ensure the several hundred-pound seat didn't tilt.
Is that a dragon?"
The Thane directed his question to the spiders. The three Frey had returned to working in tandem, humming softly and rocking in a synchronized motion. At the question, they stopped just in time to see it breathe fire.
"That's not possible,"
Anya said. At least Mandalay thought that was her name. She'd been just one of the many Miralith faces seen on the trip, but after the first day's disaster, she had risen in stature. Up to that point, everything had been going well. The bridges had been completed without incident, and the Thane had sent one of the remaining four spiders across them with Rigorous, Hatteras, and half of the remaining Shadi. This left father and son on the hill in front of the big tent, with Sile, Sine, three spiders, and Tarane with his 12 ornately dressed members of the Lion Corps. Mandalay was certain most positions in the corps were filled according to political favour rather than martial prowess, and he doubted the lions could be relied on for anything more than staking tents. After the calamity of the day before, everyone had held their breaths as they watched the invasion. Wanderlei's father hadn't even looked. He'd stood up and paced. Sile and Sine walked with him. The Thane had walked off into the darkness behind the tent twice, only to return and sit back down. The bridges had held. The Shadi had crossed, and the moment they did, the remaining spiders, who were freed of their responsibilities to guard the spans, began a barrage of attacks intended to soften the army's path. Progress had been slower than his father had hoped, as evidenced by his constant complaints during the passing hours. When the servants had dished out a late-night meal of cold meat and day-old bread, he and his father had listened to Tarane explain that Alan Rist was designed to make it difficult for an assault. Narrow pathways and plenty of bridges and stairs created choke points and gave defenders the advantage. From their vantage point, Mandalay had watched as the Shadi began by clearing most of the city before scaling the stairs to the fortress. Despite the spider his father had sent with them, the advancement had taken hours just to reach the upper courtyard. Mandalay had been allowed one small part in the battle. With Gerard's siphoned power and his father's guidance, he used Avampartha and shook the ground on the far side of the chasm. His part in the weave had been minor. Lothian just used him as a conduit. Nevertheless, father and son had shared a rare moment of joy when the dome finally caved in.
"That's more like it,"
the Thane had said, while sitting back in his chair. As morning approached and lightened the sky, his father had called for wine.
"I think this problem is finally solved." Then the dragon appeared.
At first, it was only a dark shadow against the bright fires, and Mandalay wasn't certain what he was seeing. All that changed when it breathed its own fire.
"What is it, then?" the Thane asked.
Several heartbeats of silence went by. This wasn't unusual for the spiders. There was always a delay when talking to them. "We don't know," Anya finally replied.
"What do you mean you don't know? That's why you're here. That's why you're holding hands and chanting. You're supposed to be monitoring your web. You should be able to tell me everything."
"It's not a creature of blood and bone. It's a light."
"A light?"
"It appears as a terribly bright light. Something none of us have ever seen before."
"What's this light doing?"
"It's killing our soldiers."
The Fane scowled.
"Then destroy it."
"Yes, my Fane," Anya said. And the tiny circle of spiders began to chant louder. As they did, the sky swirled.
In general, most Miralith at a certain level preferred storm art. Wanderlei, on the other hand, was partial to fire, even though nearly all of his tribe considered it mundane, or even childish. He just enjoyed the sense of power, the ease of the draw and release. Storms were more complicated and took far longer to prepare, and he never thought the results were all that impressive.
"My Fane!"
Taranay pointed to the north at a rider racing across the plain. The rider was one of the wolf scouts. He wore no armor, just his wolf helm and blue cape. Lothian set his wine down and stood up. Reaching the encampment, the rider thundered to a stop, dismounted, and ran forward to kneel at the Fane's feet.
"What is it?"
Lothian asked.
"My Fane, a large army approaches from the southeast."
An army?"
the Fane said, with a baffled expression, as he looked to those around him for answers.
"The Gularunes, my Fane."
"How many?"
Taranay asked.
"Many thousands, my lord."
"There,"
Sion said, pointing with her quick hands. Revealed by the first light of the brightening dawn, a large host of runes appeared, cresting the distant hill. As the fray watched, the rune army split into two groups, half making for Alan Rist, the others wheeling in their direction. Even divided, the number of runes facing them was overwhelming. There weren't just thousands, but tens of thousands, and they did not walk in rows, but in a mass, a jumble like a herd of deer. Even at that distance, Wanderlei heard their shouts, an awful, constant roar as they gleefully charged down the slope.
"You didn't see them?"
Lothian asked the spiders.
"We were concentrating on the battle in the fortress, my Fane."
"Blind fools!"
"Do you still wish us to—"
"Forget the dragon! Destroy the army!"
Everyone who could run did, including Roan. The Galarabrin was supposed to be on their side, but trust wasn't one of Roan's virtues. She'd spent a lifetime learning better ways to hide. Since the beast was 3 stories tall, had a wingspan of about 90 feet, teeth in excess of 1 foot long, and the newly revealed ability to breathe fire, Roan didn't need any further incentive. When the Galarabrin landed in the courtyard, everyone scattered. She hadn't seen Suri leave, but after all, it was her creation. The foolish had advanced to attack it.
"Not foolish," Roan decided.
"They're brave.
They just don't know what they're doing."
After getting far enough away for comfort, Roan turned. She'd never seen a Galarabrin in daylight. Scales she had remembered as black were more a dark green. They glistened like metal, acted like it too. Swords and spears did nothing, and Frey soldiers died, crushed or devoured. Oblivious and terrified, some of the men attacked as well. The beast ignored them the way a big dog might act with a bratty toddler. There was still danger. The Galarabrin was huge and powerful. Every movement brought havoc. A swish of its tail demolished walls, crushing those nearby.
The flip of its wings raised a dust storm that blinded and choked. Since there were only two exits out of the courtyard, one down a stair through the rubble to the city, and the other up a stair toward the big domed building that led toward the Kuipe, Roan ran for the safety of the Kuipe. She had hoped to join Persephone, Bryn, and Moya, but the big dome had collapsed, making passage through the rotunda impossible. Now, the only way up was the narrow stairs that led around. Going that way was slow and jammed with people. Those trapped at the base were being slaughtered.
There has to be a better way. I could hide.
As she looked around for a crevice to crawl into, another Frey soldier spotted her alone and in the open. She caught the glint of a smile on his face. That same Ivor smile she'd seen so many times in the past. This one, who still had a helm that was made to look like the head of a bear, was drenched in blood, a lavish splatter that added crimson to the copper-hued armour as it beaded on the surface, running down in tears. He walked toward her. She walked away, hoping he wasn't really interested in her. He started jogging. She ran. The stair leading up was a death trap, and hiding was no longer possible. So Roan started toward the beast, hoping it would know who she was. But at that moment, the Galarabrin flew off. This left only one option, the stairs down to the city. That way was disturbingly empty.
"This is not a good idea. This is not a good idea. This is not a good idea."
"Shut up! I'm trying to concentrate!" she yelled at herself. "Can't you see I'm running down steps?"
Reaching the bottom, she found the streets to the city blocked by rubble. She had no choice but to follow the path to the lower courtyard, which, like the upper, had been pummeled to pebbles. She'd had a good start on the fray. He was halfway across the yard when they began the race, and he was slowed by armor, a sword, and shield.
"Maybe he's given up and gone after easier prey."
She didn't bother to look, though. Didn't need to. Roan heard the clap of shoulder plates behind her. When she hit the lower courtyard, Roan took advantage of the open field and sprinted hard. Her only hope was distance. Rabbits survived by becoming too much effort to chase, and Roan planned to be one bothersome bunny. For the first time, she regretted her tool belt. The many utensils slowed her down as they flapped and swung. Bodies lay everywhere, human and Frey lying side by side. She tried not to look at the faces, didn't want to see someone she knew. Roan ran past the speech rock, heading toward the only open route available, the front gate, or what was left of it. Somewhere in the depths of her desperate mind, she saw it as salvation, a finish line, a point of escape. Even though there was no door to close, no brace to throw, no wall to hide behind. And the enemy army had its camp on the far side of the gorge. In reality, there were just two big bronze gates lying on the ground beside the residue of a stone wall. But a goal was a goal.
"Leaving the fortress is a really, really, really bad idea."
"Shut up!"
Behind her, the Frey let out a grunt. He was still after her, and closer than ever. Roan felt her legs growing tired. Worse, she was having trouble breathing. She just couldn't pull in enough air.
"I'm going to die."
Roan passed the fallen bronze doors and the collapsed ramparts that had become massive stones of broken architecture. Ahead of her, all that was left was the ford, where seven magically made stone bridges stitched the two sides of the chasm together. She was running for the center one, but running was an optimistic term for what she was doing. She'd been steadily slowing down, her flight reduced to little more than a jog by the time she could see into the chasm. Despite the dark clouds overhead, there was a gap at the horizon,
and the brilliant yellow face of the sun shone through that opening. As she ran due east, the piercing light blinded her to nearly everything that lay ahead. What she did see was an army, and the silhouette of a warrior on horseback, riding across the center bridge. "I'm trapped!" The race was over. As if to punctuate this, lightning began flashing out of the sky, striking on the far side of the chasm. The turmoil in the heavens, the shouts and cries of men, the cracks and booms all told the same story. No point in running any more. With lungs burning, Roan came to a stop, struggling to breathe and waiting to die. At that moment, a new contest began. Who will reach me first? The rider crossing the bridge, or the Frey from behind? Roan managed a miserable smile. So much effort for the daughter of a slave. She didn't care who won, but looking out through bleary eyes at the cliff before her, a new thought popped into her head. I can always jump. There was a certain satisfaction in denying both of them the pleasure of her death. And what if killing me isn't their intent? Roan turned off the path to the bridge and aimed for the cliff.
You deserve everything you get.
She heard the familiar words, but this time the voice didn't sound like Ivor. He was dead. She finally knew that to be true because she'd killed him twice, once with poison and once with a metal punch and an assist from Banger the Heavy. Exhausted and unable to run, Roan began to cry as she realized she wouldn't make it to the cliff's edge in time to kill herself. The rider was coming at her too hard, too fast. She saw the mounted warrior draw his sword. He was a faceless silhouette against the bright morning sun, but she heard it, the ring of that metal coming free of its scabbard. Only, that sound was unmistakable. Not bronze. That was steel. As the rider drew closer, she saw the glint of silver. Beneath the helm was a beautiful, misaligned face.
Gifford!
She cried, sacrificing the last remaining air in her lungs. He rode at her pursuer, swinging his sword, missing badly. It didn't matter. Whether by intent or accident, the horse trampled the Frey. Having ridden past Roan, Gifford wheeled around. As he did, the full face of the rising sun shone on his armour and upon his white horse. Dazzling and bright, Gifford gleamed like a morning star, wondrous and beautiful. He glowed.
Woon! I can't get down.
Gifford leaned over and extended his arm.
Please, you have to take my hand.
She didn't think, didn't hesitate. Reaching out, she grabbed hold of that offered arm and let Gifford pull her up behind him. Then she hugged him around his waist.
You're alive, you're alive, you're alive,
she cried, squeezing as hard as she could.
Roan, Gifford said, you know you hugging me. You touching me, Roan.
I know.
As Gula runes charged across the bridge and poured into the fortress of Alenrist, Roan laid her head on Gifford's back. Once more she heard the words.
You deserve everything you get.
The voice wasn't Ivor's, after all.
It was her mother's.
Chapter 30 The Dragon.
At first, I thought it was a dragon, savage and fierce. I wish that had been true. Dragons only kill you. Ilara Bryn's, break your heart. The Book of Bryn. Persephone stared in disbelief. Above them was open sky. The roof to the Kuiper had been ripped off. Most of it was wood, but there had been stone as well, and a dragon had torn it away like a cork from a jug. Then it began to kill. Persephone assumed the beast was another weapon of the Fane. "He has giants, magicians, and storms. Why not a dragon?" She closed her eyes, waiting for death. She cringed, expecting the crush of claws or the bite of teeth. Nothing happened. Even the screams of the dying fell silent. She heard only the sound of the dragon's breathing, and then the sound of Bryn's voice.
"Mara, mother of us all, protect us! Mara, mother of us all, protect us!"
Letting go of her sword, Persephone reached out and found the girl. She clutched her arm, then found her hand.
"Mara, mother of us all, protect us!"
Persephone added her voice. Pedera joined in their prayer. A moment later, Moya did too. Persephone reached out again, found Moya's foot, and held on. The anticipation of the death blow was maddening, but Persephone still held tightly to Bryn and Moya. Finally, she chanced a look. The fray that had been the threat only moments before were gone. Only Nephron, Ares, and Tegan were still alive. The dragon was still there, too, perched on the corner of the Kuiper, anchored by its massive talons. She felt its hot breath, and tilted her head higher to see its face. She realized, with horror, that the dragon, with its two massive eyes and oblong pupils, wasn't merely looking at them. It was staring at her.
"It will kill me now. Open its mouth and swallow me whole."
It didn't. The dragon continued to stare. Finally, it did open its mouth. But instead of devouring her, the dragon spoke. With a voice more powerful than thunder, deeper than the groan of the rock, it said,
"Even now."
The dragon waited a moment more. Then, extending its wings, it pushed off, crushing a block of stone the size of a moose.
"Unbuckle his armor," Pedera shouted. "Get it off."
The old woman was on the floor at the foot of the bed, working on Tekchin, who lay sprawled on his back in a pool of blood. Moya, who was up and moving again, scrambled to him, and began jerking the leather straps at the Galantian's shoulder.
"Got him good," Pedera said, "bleeding like a speared boar. Bryn, grab the bandages on the table, and get me that belt."
No one else spoke. A roar erupted a short distance away, but still nothing happened. Not to them. Distant screams were followed by a flap of wings. After that, silence.
"How the tet does this culling armor come off?" Moya shouted as she jerked on the leather straps of Tekchin's plate.
Blood spilled from a puncture just below his ribs.
"Just cut it off," Pedera told her. "Persephone, give me your blade." "Persephone?"
"Here." Bryn tossed down the bandages, followed by one of Roan's daggers. Rapid footfalls grew louder. Nephron raised his sword, only to lower it again when Anwyr rushed in.
"What happened?" "About to ask you the same thing," Nephron replied. "Where'd the dragon come from? And where is it now?"
"Dragon?"
Anwyr asked, confused. He looked up.
"Where'd the roof go?"
"Forget all that," Pedera yelled at them.
She pointed at Tekchin, where Moya was desperately trying to saw through the thick leather straps with Bryn's sword, but they were hidden under the shoulder plates and hard to get at.
"Your friend is dying."
"He's fine," Nephron sounded annoyed. "He's had worse and pulled through."
"He's bleeding to death. Any of you killers know how to get this armor off?"
Anwyr, who proved adept with straps and ties, bent down and helped Moya.
Bryn, needle and thread, Padera ordered. Near the basin. Thread it. Squeeze, Padera told Moya.
They had the breastplate off and had cut Tekchin's shirt away.
Don't be afraid. Press hard.
Bryn came over with the needle.
Now, here, Bryn, get the flaps of skin closer together. That's it.
Padera started sewing. When she was done, she sat back and wiped sweat from her brow.
Okay, wrap him, Padera told Moya and Bryn. And don't be timid about it. Pull the strips tight.
You gonna live?
Ares asked the old woman. Padera stood up, her hands stained dark. She took a towel and wiped them off, leaving brilliant streaks of red on the pale cloth.
Depends on how much his god likes him. Busted a rib, and caught part of a lung sac. He could just as easily drown in his own blood.
Moya sat bent over Tekchin, crying.
Don't you dare die, you son of the Tetlin whore!
Padera turned toward the bed.
Persephone? You okay? Are you hurt?
Tesh came through what was left of the door.
Tesh!
Bryn sprinted across the room and hugged the boy, nearly knocking him off his feet.
You're alive!
Where have you been?
Tegan asked, then looked at the blood on Tesh's swords.
Finally got to kill some elves, eh?
Tesh glared at him for a second, then smiled.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. The sound of battle was gone. All around was the sound of wind blowing over the top of the kype and the flutter of some unseen fabric.
So, what's all this about a dragon?
Anwyr asked again. A tear slipped down Persephone's cheek, her voice soft and quavering.
It's not a dragon.
What's going on? What are you seeing? Gerard shouted in his head.
Wanderlei watched with delight as lightning struck the gula, killing them. Flash, crackle, drop. Flash, crackle, flame. Over and over, the storm delivered an unnatural series of killer bolts that left him seeing afterstreaks. These runes did not wear the special armor, and strike after strike, the lightning killed. While dozens of bolts fired at the same time, there were still thousands and thousands of gula charging at them, big hairy brutes with spears and rough wooden shields. Clearly, the fray could easily kill several hundred, but then be slaughtered by the rest.
How can there be so many? They're like rats.
His father realized this as well.
Anya, create a firewall.
A firewall? Why?
Gerard asked. A moment later, as the barbarians threw themselves into a wailing run, a 10-foot wall of flames appeared between the gula and the last cohort of Shadi. This flaming fence began in the middle of the field, then rapidly ran out to either side. Wanderlei didn't understand why the spiders didn't just blast the savages with torrents of flame. Their strategy became clearer as the wall began to move. It curled around, driving the gula west, toward the Burn River, toward the cliff.
"Fire the bridges!" the Fane ordered,
and in a few seconds fire appeared on all seven of them.
"Have you become deaf, or just stupid?"
Gerard asked, his tone an ever-increasing whine of frustration.
"Answer me! What are you seeing?"
He'd asked the same question every few minutes since the battle started. At first, Wanderlei had complied, whispering descriptions, but he grew tired of narrating. He found the process irritating and demeaning. He hadn't invited Gerard to sit in his head that morning, and felt no obligation to relay information like some courier.
"Push them off the cliff," his father said. "Not too fast, a slow and steady creep. I want them to have the opportunity to ponder their fate. Give them the time to choose between jumping to their death or burning alive.
The Thane picked up his wine once more and sat down. He swirled the contents in the cup.
This is the way my mother used to do it. Show them what it means to go to war against the Miraleith, he said, staring out at the thousands beyond the wall of fire that marched unerringly forward. This is your reward.
He gestured to the servant to fill another cup.
Have some wine, Wanderley. I don't like to drink alone.
His father was in a dark but generous mood, at least toward him. Wanderley didn't answer. The sight and the anticipation were fascinating. An unrelenting wall of fire drove more people than he'd ever seen in one place toward a sheer drop. A few runes tried to run through. He saw them catch fire and fall. When the wall moved past, he could see their scorched bodies, lumps in a smoking black field. As the wall pressed, those caught inside were squeezed. Those in the rear, row by row, line by line, began to slip into the chasm.
"It's coming," Sine said.
"What is?" the Thane asked.
"The light,"
she said, pointing up at the sky. Wanderley looked toward the fortress and spotted the dark winged creature coming at them. The dragon that had breathed fire was getting larger by the second, and Wanderley already thought it was pretty big.
"Sign," his father said. "Use lightning. Kill it."
Lightning crackled, and a jagged finger of blue-white light struck the beast. It didn't even dip with the impact, didn't fall. It barely altered its flight. Again and again, Sign jolted the dragon with bolts. The thing kept coming.
"Damn you, Wanderley! What are you seeing?"
"The art!"
Sign sounded confused.
"The art has no effect on it."
"No effect," Jared said in his head. "That doesn't make sense. What does it look like? Scratch that. What does it feel like? Look at it with the eyes of the art."
"A bright light. Looks and feels like power,"
Wanderley said softly.
"Power?"
"Feels like the art."
"Art doesn't affect art, Wanderley. If what you say is true, they are trying to burn a fire or flood an ocean. It won't work."
"Jared says the dragon is the art, and the art can't damage itself," Wanderley told his father.
The Thane glanced at Wanderley, his eyes losing confidence. Once more, he set down his wine and stood up. The beast was crossing the chasm, wings beating in a steady rhythm, tail straight out behind it. Larger and larger it became.
"How big is it?" Wanderley thought. "How can that be the art?"
The Thane took a step forward, cast off his cloak, and with a deep hum and a wave of his arm, the Thane sent forth a blast of fire that coursed across the sky, striking the beast in the chest. The flames did nothing, and the monster appeared to swim through the blaze. Then, as if given the idea, the dragon opened its mouth and replied in kind. A blast of fire shot from its mouth at the hill. Instantly, the flame wall marching toward the Gula vanished when the Miraleith abandoned it in exchange for protection. A defense screen was one of the first things a Miraleith learned. The crossed arms and buzzing sound became as much a reflex as throwing out one's hands in a fall. Wanderley put up his own shield. So did his father. And Sine threw up a defense over the Thane. But the spiders, by virtue of their training, reacted differently. They combined their efforts, creating a small dome that capped the hilltop. In doing so, They saved the lives of those few servants lucky enough to be standing close by, including Treya, Terenay, and his 12 lions.